From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, will cats snuggle up to fans or end up in the box office litter box? Then, 1917 is a World War I drama from director Sam Mendes. He felt the movie needed to unfold in a single continuous shot.
This is a real historic event, and there's a certain amount of respect that needs to be paid for the people who live through it. You want people to fear what the characters are fearing, and I think that the one shot helps with that.
And Catherine Bostick is a musical rarity, a songwriter and film composer who performs her own work. It's The Frame. Stay with us. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn.
Tonight is a magical night.
All that I wanted.
Where I choose the cat.
Was to be wanted.
That deserves a new life.
And so maybe my home isn't what I had known.
That's Judi Dench and Taylor Swift from the trailer for the movie version of Cats, which arrives in theaters this weekend. Crawls might be a better word, as director Tom Hooper's adaptation of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical has been absolutely savaged by critics. Produced for about $100 million, the Universal Pictures movie represents a big bet that a blockbuster stage show can yield a hit movie. But audience surveys suggest Cats may have a tough time at the box office, where it faces the latest Star Wars sequel. Steven Zeitchik covers Hollywood for The Washington Post, and he starts by explaining Universal's thinking in making the movie.
Cats comes with a huge built-in audience, and so I think they felt that this was a great holiday play for a big blockbuster-type film that isn't based on, you know, a comic book or a piece of intellectual property of that sort, but can still break through with an audience.
When the first trailer premiered, it did attract a lot of attention, not all of it positive. So once people started seeing images from the film, what were the conversations about the look and feel of director Tom Hooper's movie?
Yeah, well, look, I think this was always going to be a bit of a polarizing one because, you know, even on stage, it was somewhat polarizing between critics and audiences. You know, I think Tom Hooper, the director, and his team made a very specific choice here to use this digital fur where they basically shot the actors not in costume. And then they added the costumes later and did a lot of things in the post-production room. And I think, you know, some people are going to find that very exciting. That's something that, you know, the CG is allowing for computer-generated imagery, is allowing for, you know, images we've never seen before. Others will find it falling into that uncanny valley where it doesn't look quite cartoonish enough to feel like a good animated film, but it doesn't feel realistic enough to feel authentic.
Authentic, as in, what does a singing cat really look like, right? That's the basic question. Okay, I just want to make sure we got that straight. Let's just say that critics have really enjoyed writing some very negative things about this film. I'm going to cite one critic. I don't know him. His name is Alan Corr. He writes for RTE in Ireland. Here's his blurb. First off, full disclosure, I am not a cat person. Second off, after watching this frankly mortifying film adaptation of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats, I'm not altogether sure I'm a movie person anymore either. Do the critics actually matter for a movie like this?
You know, I think they do to a very small extent. Obviously not in the way they do to a big movie like Irishman or Marriage Story. That's a big player in award season. You know, it's funny, John, Cats and Star Wars are coming out pretty much at the same time. And I think with both of these films, you're seeing some pretty negative critical reaction. And I think from fans, the response is, so what? You know, we love these properties. We love to see everything that a director does to them, or love to see our favorite actors inhabit these characters on stage. So, you know, look, I think when it comes to kind of maybe pulling some folks in who are a little bit on the fence, who maybe in this case with Cats saw the show at some point in one of its many runs over the years, and they're thinking about going over the holidays, you know, will a reviewer or a critic kind of sway them one way or the other? I think they might. But I think for a lot of the hardcore fans, judging by the reaction on social media, they're going to go see this movie and maybe see this movie repeatedly, regardless of what critics say.
We're talking with Steve Zeitchik at The Washington Post about the movie version of Cats. It feels like the people who are very good about predicting box office are a little bit stumped over this one. And I've seen some people comparing it to a film that came out 2 years ago, Greatest Showman, which didn't open very well, under $10 million, and ultimately grossed almost $200 million in domestic theaters. What are the models that people are looking at for Cats? And even if it doesn't open well, might it play for a while?
Yeah, that's certainly the big question here. I've been covering this industry for a long time, as have you, John, and we tend to know before a movie comes out what the box office is going to look like. Cats is a complete enigma. I think the opening, it's pretty safe to say, is going to be fairly modest, though you never know. But I think you're right. The long play, the legs, as Hollywood likes to call it, where sort of word of mouth drives people into theaters over the course, in this case, of the holidays and maybe even beyond, is what the hope is. You know, Greatest Showman is a model. It opened very small and had this big run over $400 million worldwide as well. I think that The Greatest Showman's a little bit different because that was a title people didn't know, so they weren't going to come out opening weekend. It had Hugh Jackman, but it was a new musical. It had to kind of find its legs. It had to take some time for people to discover it. Cats, I think, is very well known, and people have opinions about it. So, I don't know if it's going to have that same long tail that, as it were, that long period of discovery that that Greatest Showman did. But that doesn't mean that over the holidays, where every day folks are looking for things to do, things to do with the kids, that Cats can't get in there and really outperform its opening weekend.
I have seen some executives from Universal Pictures over the last week or so, and they have two movies that are coming out. Cats is one of them. 1917, Sam Mendes' World War I drama, is the other. They seem really excited about their drama film about the war, not so much about Cats. How much is at stake for Universal? Because they don't have the library of titles that a company like Disney with Marvel and Star Wars has. It's about probably $100 million investment just to make this movie. How important is it to the studio itself?
You're absolutely right. You know, Universal, they have Fast and Furious, they have Jurassic Park, but they're not in the same league as some of their competitors when it comes to, you know, the really big franchise titles. I think the hope with 1917 is that, you know, it will catch on with critics as it already has. It'll catch on with awards voters and tastemakers. You know, Cats, I think, is a very different play. It's a holiday play. It's a family-oriented film. And so, you know, there, I think what they're really hoping for, as we've been talking about, is kind of getting people in over the holidays, getting them to discover it, not really relying on the media so much as on social media. So two very different approaches for a studio that could really use a hit or two this time of year.
Steve Zeitschik covers entertainment for The Washington Post. Steve, thanks so much for not only coming on the show, but also seeing Cats so you could talk about it.
Here to help, John. Thank you.
If you don't care what critics say and have some time to kill, Cats is in theaters now. Coming up on The Frame, director Sam Mendes and cinematographer Roger Deakins on the camera wizardry in their new film, 1917. The upcoming film, 1917, is an ambitious World War I drama. It stars George Mackay and Dean Charles Chapman. They play young soldiers tasked with a difficult and thankless mission. The film was co-written and directed by Sam Mendes, who directed American Beauty, and oddly enough, it's from the same studio that made Cats. To pull off his idea for how to shoot it, Mendes turned to famed cinematographer Roger Deakins. He's been nominated for 14 Oscars and won the last time he was in competition for Blade Runner 2049. Mendes has a background in live theater, and that helped him when making 1917, which plays out as a single continuous shot.
I feel like I use a lot of my theater muscles when it came to staging individual scenes, for example, particularly in compressed spaces in the trenches and in dugouts and rooms and what have you. So there are similarities. The difference is, however, that the landscape is constantly moving and the camera is constantly moving.
Your orders are to get to the second at Kwasi Wood, 1 mile southeast of the town of Bakust. Deliver this to Colonel McKenzie. It is a direct order to call off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, it will be a massacre.
It's about two people most of the time in a vast landscape and trying to do justice not only to their emotional journey, but to the huge panorama of destruction that they're moving through and trying to let the movie breathe in and breathe out, whereas on stage, you're kind of just always breathing in.
When you look at playback, Roger, and you're checking to see if a shot works, how do you make sure that the shot itself works, that you're getting what you need cinematically, and that you're getting performance? And how do you score a certain scene to make sure that both are at the level that you're happy with?
I mean, I don't usually on a film watch playback much. I mean, I was watching playback on this quite a bit. But it was very different because the shots were worked out very well in advance. The takes we were looking back at were small things to finesse, maybe with the camera or something we might discuss about the relationship of the actors to the camera, yeah. if the actors were too lined up, or something simple yeah. like
but
that.
But interestingly, when we've got it, we almost never would watch playback. We just came out of our respective horse boxes, which were often miles away from where the action ended up, because these people were, the lads were travelling half a mile in one shot, you know, and we would just look at each other and say, yeah, that's it.
Mother! It's Mother!
We should put him out of his misery.
No, get him some water, he needs water.
I remember talking to the producer, Mark Abraham, who made Children of Men, and there are a lot of long takes in that film. And he would tell me about calling the studio, the same studio, Universal, and they'd say, what do you got for us today? And he's like, we don't have anything. We didn't get a shot. So when you have a tough day, what are the results? And are there some days, for whatever reason, weather or something else, where you don't get a shot, but you know that you're moving forward?
Yes, there were lots of days we didn't get a shot. But the great stroke of genius was that Roger had the courage early on to say, listen, if we're not in cloud, we aren't going to be able to shoot.
Saying that was more suicidal and genius, actually. But
meaning sunlight was your worst enemy, because yes. then you can't match?
The sun comes out once in the film, and that's the last shot of the film where I wanted it to come out.
He arranged it. It cost him a lot of money. But we told the studio in the first production meeting, and to their immense credit, they did go a bit pale, but they didn't freak out. And they trusted us that we were going to get it in the end. And we were lucky with the weather. Having said that, we also prepped the hell out of it for months and months and months. And we worked very, very hard. And there were days which were extremely frustrating. But they were generally forgotten immediately, because you get the shot and then you move on and you're so thrilled and exhilarated to have got it.
Roger, I want to ask you about the rules for where the camera goes. There's an early shot when there are a couple of soldiers, they approach a pond, and the soldiers go left around the pond.
Did you hear that story about Wilco? How he lost his ear?
Not in the mood. Keep your eyes on the trees, top of the ridge.
At this point, your cameras have pretty much been following them, and it's one of the first places where the camera goes the other way. And it's a lovely shot. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking and mapping out the story, was that something, if you're shooting sequentially, where you say, this is where we have to go and this is going to be the rule that we're going to follow, that the camera's going to go where the shot is, not necessarily where the actors are?
Yeah, but I got to say, I think one thing that informed me about it, about our relationship and how we approached it, was the first film I shot for Sam, which was Jarhead. We did a lot of long involving sequences, shots, and allowed the actors to do what they wanted. And it was a very organic, an overused word, but it was a very organic process, a dance between the camera and the actors. And I felt that really helped where we went with this film, because in a way it started off very similarly to that. You wanted that connection with the main characters, and you didn't want to take the audience out by doing something was ostentatious. But that particular moment you're talking about was kind of, yeah, you need to see where they are. So that just felt right. I mean, it is in a way breaking a language, but it's not. You're still with them.
No, it felt like that scene was where you tipped your hand, that the camera's going to have it both ways.
Yeah.
It will be both with them and looking at them.
And at times, I mean, you know, we also took some, you know, because we'd worked through 2/3 of the movie, there's a moment in the latter part of the movie when the camera, you know, in a nighttime town lit by flares and fire, detaches entirely from the character and finds him later. And we sort of looked at each other and felt like, yeah, we've earned this moment, because we'd worked out the relationship between the character and the camera for the first 2/3 of the film.
We're talking with Sam Mendes and Roger Deakins about their film 1917. Roger, there was so much planning in terms of camera moves, rehearsal, blocking in this film. Were there some accidents as well, things that you hadn't planned on that you ended up using? And can you think of a couple?
Yeah, only when George ran into the extras, or the extras ran into George on that final run down the trench line. And it was just too good not to use, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, and George was fantastic, because he'd get up and do it again.
This is the final charge scene where he's literally getting knocked over like a rugby or football player.
Yeah.
you're trying to make this immersive, and yet there are requirements for the story in terms of what have to be in the shots. And I'm thinking of animals, rats, birds, things like that. How much of that are you able to shoot practically so that the actors are reacting to what's around them? And how much by necessity do you have to add through visual effects toward the end?
Well, I mean, some of those elements are obviously CG, yeah.
But there's a real baby.
I was just going to say the baby's real when you would think, oh, well, the baby's CG. But there was one particular baby that Sam had auditioned or whatever, and that came on. It was like the fourth one we shot, I think. Yeah. And it was like perfect.
Yeah, every take, gold dust.
I saw the film last night, and I was sitting next to a woman who, for the majority of the film, was in a fetal position, cowering.
Oh, God.
But the fact that this woman was viscerally fearful, as if she was in a horror movie, to me kind of spoke to the way I imagine you hope the film works.
The key is that you don't want to feel as an audience manipulated. So, and that is tricky because you are aware that this is a real historic event and that there's a certain amount of respect that needs to be paid for the people who live through it. And it's not an entertainment. But at the same time, you want people to fear what the characters are fearing. And terror and adrenaline is exactly what they live through. Long periods of boredom and waiting and then short bursts of utter terror.
Come on! I can't see! I can't see! Oh, stop! Stop! It's a mine shaft! But we have to jump!
I think that the one shot helps with that because I think you feel in a weird way pulled in, claustrophobic, that you know, you begin to feel, even if you don't intellectually understand it, you begin to feel there is no way out.
There are large parts of this film with no dialogue. When you are thinking as you're shooting about the role that music is going to play and Thomas Newman's score, how does it govern not only the shooting, but editorial choices?
It was incredibly helpful to have someone who I have a very good shorthand with and have worked with for 20 years. But I was also pushing him to use music in a more expressive way than sometimes he's done. You know, there were several scenes that he said, "You sure you don't want me to score this?" And I would say, "No, I want it to be silent here." And we talked a lot about displaced emotion. Sometimes the big emotional scenes happen in silence, and it's only after the event, you know, some minutes later, that the music expresses what's just happened. So we talked a lot about how and whether that was possible in this movie, which is such a present tense film. You only see what the characters see. You never see ahead of where they are. You don't see anything before they do, and sometimes you see it after they do.
Roger, let me ask you this last question. There have been a lot of films about World War II, and I think part of what your film gets at is that thousands of people died over hundreds of yards, that the carnage in relation to the geography was incalculable. And if people start thinking about what happened during World War I, what might you hope they appreciate about this war that maybe they didn't fully understand now?
I grew up in south of England in Devon, and all the little villages and towns in Devon have a monument in there at the center on the village green. And I know one in particular. It's got 25 names on it. It's got six names, all the surnames the same. It's got another five, all the surnames the same. All those kids came from the same family. This is a little rural village in Devon, and that's all over the country. And it's so sad that those sacrifices are forgotten. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional, but I was brought up seeing that. And I always wondered what happened. And I've been so interested in studying both the wars because of that. I think this film, if it brings back some memory and some interest in it again, but I got to say, if we showed what was really in some of the photographs that we saw in references, there wouldn't be anybody in the audience after 5 minutes. I mean, it was horrendous.
Sam and Roger, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sam Mendes is the director and co-writer of 1917. Roger Deakins is the film cinematographer. The movie opens in theaters on Christmas Day. After a short break, singer-songwriter Catherine Bostick has been shortlisted for the Academy Awards. That's next on The Frame. The 15 songs on the shortlist for the Academy Award music categories were announced this week. They will be narrowed down to 5 finalists when Oscar nominations come out on January 13th. One of the nominees in the original song category is songwriter and composer Catherine Bostic. She wrote and performed the end title song from the documentary Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. Bostic also composed the score for and produced the new Alfre Woodard movie, Clemency, which opens December 27th. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited Bostic at her home studio.
There aren't many film composers who are also singer-songwriters. Danny Elfman and Randy Newman come to mind, but it's a small club. Catherine Bostic is a rare Renaissance woman. She writes classical concert music, film music, plays the piano, and writes and sings her own songs.
I think I was 7 years old, and I wrote this little piano piece. I had figured out a chord progression. I was very excited about it, and I remember calling my mother into the room and playing this little cadence. Well, you know, music is a conversational component of film magic. And since I've always been so sensitive to music and so sensitive to the way it makes me feel and what it can evoke, that ability to then marry it to a film and help enhance that story, help enhance that emotional intent, is very powerful to me.
Right, let me get some water real quick.
We're at Catherine Bostic's studio, a musical crow's nest in Sherman Oaks, 3 floors up a spiral staircase. She's singing the song she wrote for Clemency, the new film starring Alfre Woodard as a prison warden.
Come on and find me, find me. Slow train tonight, baby, please find me.
So Slow Train is a song that I wrote for the character Bernadine. She has been going through a lot of trauma with her job as the warden, and it's affected her marriage, and her husband has separated from her. The director, Chenonier, one of the first notes I got from her was the character Bernadine loves the blues. And I just had this image of this slow train moving, you know, this slow train of emotions that reflect the kind of groundswell of emotions she's going through in beginning to release all of this trauma as the warden on death row.
Oh, find me, on the slow train tonight. On the slow train tonight.
I just feel very fortunate. It's not always a given, you know, that you can also sing on a score you're working on. And in this case, and also in the Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am documentary, I had that great opportunity as well.
When the crimson moon low rides the night, there's a shine on the water where secrets burn bright.
I had been asked to write the end title song, and immediately I was thinking about the scene in the documentary where Toni Morrison is describing the flight of slaves who were in transit to America and how the ancestral majesty of them, many were able to fly and release themselves from that horrific journey by flying back home and flying with the protection of ancestral love and guidance and strength.
For the broken, the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
And that just really struck me about how there's this source and this force that can actually transport people, our people, African Americans, through times of tremendous strife. And so I felt like I needed to have a song that was kind of like this anthem.
Above the gathering stones, into ancient arms, above the water.
Well, you know, the voice is such a primal and visceral part of anybody's self-expression. I mean, you hear somebody's voice and right away you can sense things about them. And when I'm singing,
It's just this energy of communicating with a very strong presence that is very spiritual and heartfelt and evocative. In fact, I like to write from that place as well as a composer. So to be able to sing from that place, it's another layer of that kind of connection.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
The documentary Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, featuring Catherine Bostick's song High Above the Water, is available on Hulu and other streaming platforms. And before we sign off, just a reminder that The Frame's digital newsletter goes out every Thursday. It's a great way to keep up with our show and get some headlines from the world of culture. And we always include tips from our friends at LAS.com on how to spend the weekend. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. And that will do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.